you better really have a good understanding of the game and how to teach and how to help players get better.
On this episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast, we are joined by Coach Chris Caputo, the head men's basketball coach at George Washington University. Coach Caputo began his coaching career as a student assistant at Westfield State before joining Jim Larrañaga's staff at George Mason. He was part of the legendary 2006 George Mason Final Four run and followed Larrañaga to the University of Miami, where he spent over a decade, eventually becoming associate head coach. In 2022, Caputo was named the head coach at GW, bringing with him a reputation for player development, recruiting, and defensive intensity. He's helped develop multiple NBA players and led Miami to several NCAA tournament appearances. At GW, he's focused on building a competitive, connected culture in the A-10. In this episode, we talk about how his first coaching stops came about through connections, what he looks for as a head coach in the hiring of an assistant, and mistakes he sees young coaches make when trying to network and grow in the industry. So please welcome to the podcast, Coach Chris Caputo. Dr. Dish Basketball, the number one selling shooting machine in the world, provides the most innovative game-like training with on-demand workouts, multiplayer stat tracking, and instant analytics that allow coaches and players to be better every day. All you have to do is mention Rising Coaches for an exclusive discount on a Dr. Dish shooting machine for your team. What's up, coaches, and welcome to another episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast. Alan Major and Doug Caputo here. Today, we're graced, spoiled to be able to have an opportunity to talk with the head coach, George Washington University, Coach Chris Caputo. Coach Caputo, welcome to the podcast. What's going on?
No relation that we know of.
That's right.
That we know of. Maybe back in the old country somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, we got the Ancestry.com investigation going on as we speak. So we're gonna get to the bottom of this thing and find the common tree branch somewhere. So good to
Coach,
see you, brother.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me, guys.
I've had more than enough conversations recently, and believe it or not, I literally have had that. Are you guys related? Do you know the coach over at George? Are you guys related? I was like, no, not that I'm aware of. But
I usually get the Long Island medium. People ask me if I'm related to her.
Yep. Just got that one last week. Yep.
Appreciate you guys having me on. I actually spoke at one of the early Rising Coaches events like 15 years ago. In Vegas back in the day when on the ground floor. So I haven't been invited back in 15 years. So it's nice. I'm off. I'm a long hiatus, but all good.
Yeah.
All good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Coach, you have had not as many stops, which could be ultimately a good thing, but then a lot of things to go over. I mean, as an assistant, as a player, and then ultimately as a head coach now at GW for four seasons? Or going into four seasons.
Yep.
As we like to do a lot of times, a lot of people who listen to this are younger coaches trying to get into either your shoes or just another role similar. So we like to bring you back to at least their perspective. So if you could talk about just the first opportunity going into George Mason, and then how did that first couple of years go? What was your mindset and mentality in those first couple of years as a coach?
Yeah, I can tell a couple of stories, but I think for me, from New York City, I was not a great player or anything, but played at Archbishop Molloy High School for legendary high school coach Jack Curran, who's a Hall of Fame, level coach. I was joking the other day with somebody. I think about the best guards to play at Molloy. I think about myself first, and then Kenny Anderson, Kenny Smith, Russ Smith, Cole Anthony, Kevin Joyce, the captain of the Olympic team, Brian Winters. Jersey's retired in Milwaukee. Coach Larrañaga obviously played there for Coach Curran, believe it or not. So I was a Division III player at Westfield State, Massachusetts, for a coach named Rich Sutter, who's been there 25 years, done a great job there. My high school coach was at my high school for 55 years. My college coach is like going on 25 years at our school. And then obviously with Coach Larrañaga for 20 years. So my vision of what this is is probably a lot different than jumping around to try to go get the next $10,000 or whatever. It's just not how I view, it's not how I viewed the whole thing. But I can tell two stories that about all this. One, I'm a sophomore in high school, I think, and I'm like on the JV team. And a guy who grew up on my block, we literally grew up in Queens, grew up in the same block as a guy named, his name's Guy Rancourt. He's the head coach of Western Connecticut State University in Connecticut. He was the head coach at Lycoming before that. He was at Florida State. He was at Stony Brook. And he's a great friend of mine from childhood. And he's a little bit older than me, but he played at Molloy as well. And almost like an older brother. I didn't have an older brother, an older sister. And it's almost like an older brother to me. And when the Final Four is in New York in 1996, it's at the Meadowlands. I'm assuming you were coaching then, Alan, at that time, or maybe,
So yeah, I was at Pacific at the time.
Yeah. I'm in high school, and a guy had been either coaching, like he was at that point, he had been like a high school assistant coach, or maybe had just gotten to the University of New Haven as an assistant at that time, and in Connecticut. And so he was in town. He was like, "Hey, do you want to go to?" Again, we're New York guys; we can navigate the trains pretty well and all that stuff. Can you? You want to go to the? I think it was the Hilton on Sixth Avenue. That was the headquarters. And I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. I'm just tagging along. And we go in, and it might have been the Sheraton, the Hilton. I can't remember which one on Sixth Avenue, which was the headquarters for the coaches at the Final Four. So I go in there, and I'm like Norm Roberts, who everyone knows, who just retired. Norm had coached at our high school as well, and I think was at Oral Roberts with Coach Self at the time. And these are the early days of that, and saw him in there and walking through, saw Coach K walking through, saw Tark at the bar, saw a number of different coaches wearing their polos, all this stuff. And at this point, I'm not totally sure I want to coach, but I'm thinking maybe. I love the game. I love college basketball. And I was like, man, this is incredible. I was like mystified by being in there as a young person. And then for me, I'm very, I guess I'd use the word blessed or fortunate or whatever. 10 years from that day, I was coaching in the Final Four. And so when I go back in time and you think about all the good and the bad of coaching and all the things and the sacrifices, how difficult it is and how fortunate you are. And I think about those moments and I'm like, man, not a lot of people get to do that. And I don't think it was too much about what I did myself. I think some of it is just the circumstances. You get lucky with people, with playing for Jack Curran, being friends with Guy Rancourt, being playing at Westfield State for Rich Sutter, who allowed me to keep my love of the game. And then obviously my connection with Coach Larrañaga. As I'm in college now playing, you know, I'm either like going to go work in finance was my idea. That was a really bad idea for me. That wouldn't have been right for me. Although I have a lot of friends in finance now that I wish I was working in finance. but anyway, so I would go around the, you know, especially New England, New York, where I was, you know, at the time in college, and then obviously where I lived when I went home, would go to basketball events, high school basketball events, prep school events, work camps, all that stuff like everybody did back then. And worked at a hoop group camp for Rob Kennedy, who was a great advocate of mine, and got a lot of opportunity there and got to meet Coach Larrañaga during that time. And obviously the mutual connection with Coach Curran, and we both thought the world of Coach Curran, and Coach Curran was looking out for me. And actually Paul Hewitt, who's obviously a great person, a great coach, was at Georgia Tech at the time. He's a New York guy. And as I was getting done, Coach Curran had called Paul Hewitt and said, "Hey, I got a guy who might be a good candidate for a GA." And Coach Hewitt was great. He was had no reason to be at that point an early ACC coach. And he was in contact with me a little bit. I'll never forget that. I was very thankful there. But Coach Larrañaga, he was like, "Hey, here's my email address. Let's email and stay in touch that way." And of course, he always jokes that I emailed him every day or anything. I don't think I did that. I think I had enough of a feel to know that. But yeah, we stayed in contact in a little bit. And then I'll never forget, I was like, back then, kids that you didn't have like laptops necessarily. We're in the computer lab, like doing some paper or something. So something I'd put off until the very end to try to get my work in. And I got an email from Coach Larrañaga, and it's, "Hey, can you give me a call? I have an assistance job open. I would like you to apply for the job." And I'm like, this is easy. Like, you just go from Division III assistant to right. Division I.
Here we go.
Mid-major right. team that's been the tournament a couple of times. Yeah, I got this figured out. And then when I applied for the job, and then I think he said, apply for the job and call me. So I applied for the job online, state school, you do that, all stuff. And he calls me, listen, you're not getting this job. You're not qualified to do this job, but I needed you to apply so I could talk to you about it. Cause what I'd like you to do is come and basically volunteer. And I'm like, okay, great. I'll do that. And so I called my parents and I'm like, hey, I got a great opportunity. You're going to move to DC and all this stuff. Great. What does it pay? Oh, no, it doesn't pay anything. You're paying for this. And we weren't rich or anything like that, but I was able to pull it off. And then basically I go down there and thought I knew a lot. And I really, Eric Conkle, who's the head coach at Tulsa, was hired as the assistant. He had been a GA for 2 years, 1 year at Tulsa, 1 year at Tennessee. And he was a Division III player as well. And he was very lucky to have been the staff at the time. Eric, obviously, and I came in together. I learned a lot from him because he had done the job for 2 years. And then Mike Gillian, who's at IMG now, is running basketball at IMG, was the head coach of Longwood, was there. Bill Courtney, who was with us at Miami, and George Mason, who's the head coach of Cornell. That was the staff. So it was a great staff, great people. Really learned a lot from those guys. And the last thing I'll say about that is it was an interesting time because back I was joking, like I made my own job. No one trusted me to do anything of any sort of real importance because you just get started, so you don't know what you're doing. But I made my own job. And then back then we could work camp even though you were on staff. So I'd be back at Eastern Invitational Hoop Group Camp working, but our prospects were at the camp. And so their high school coaches were there and you learn the recruit. So anyway, back then I think it's actually good what's going on now that guys are able to get on the road and on the court. The younger guys are now. Because for me, even though I wasn't on the court, I was working camp. I could make recruiting phone calls. There's a lot of things I could do back then legally that I remember the old rule, Alan, where you could go 30 miles within the high school game. If you're in DC, you could go to a lot of games and meet a lot of people. And I was very fortunate to come in that sort of volunteer, whatever administrative role at that time when the rules were what they were. It gave me a lot of exposure and opportunity that I think now we're getting back as we've deregulated some of those silly rules. Anyway, it's a long answer to the question.
You know, what I love about that, man, the one through line or common thread through everything you said there is just, it just keeps getting back to the power of relationships, right? Like we talk about it in this profession all the time. And sometimes it's an overused phrase, but it's an under-practiced phrase.
Yeah.
You know, but man, what a line of relationships there. Then who along the way was the first person that said, hey, man, I think you can be a coach? When you get that first nudge, that sees it in you first.
Yeah. Again, I think, as I said, I think all my coaches, my high school coach, my college coach gave me the confidence to think I could maybe do this. And then obviously Coach Larrañaga, for me, each year first year, I didn't really make anything. The second year I turned down, I actually turned down an assistant's job full time. That was not probably as good of a situation. And I stayed for $500 a month or something. And then the third year it was like $1,000 a month. And all along the way, I felt like I just enjoyed what I was doing. I enjoyed who we were working with. I enjoyed whatever you want to call it, the mission, the task. And I think there was a sense that, hey, I'm not like Coach L was basically like, hey, listen, I'll decide whether you move up or not. That's my decision. But there was a sense the longer it went, that, okay, maybe this was going to happen. And so the fourth year, I was able to move up. And obviously, it was beneficial. Because then they couldn't get rid of me and never left. And there's 20 years of that. And I think the last seven was the associate head coach. And I learned a lot, obviously, and owe a lot to Coach Larrañaga and his wife and all that, just because they really took me in. As when you're 21, 22 years old, you think you know because you care and you like it, but you don't know now. Yeah. So just you're gonna make mistakes. Yeah, make a lot of mistakes.
No, that's great. No, it's like the movie You, Me, and Dupree, right? Owen Wilson. I couldn't get rid of the guy.
Couldn't get rid of the guy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it was. That's awesome, man. Just you've had some tremendous influences. Yeah, let it rip, Dougie. I know you got another one for him.
No, I was going to say, and you said before that you wish that you would have got into finance. The way it's transitioning right now, getting it's not fully financed, but it's starting to pick it up a little bit. So
when I learned what private equity was, I was like, wow, those guys, they seems like a pretty good job. Like, you're pretty well. But no. Yeah, look, I think being well-rounded, though, has always been a good thing. And it's certainly now more than ever being well-rounded. Some of the things that I think might make you a really good assistant are really important, but they don't always translate to being a good head coach either. You know what I mean? Think when your head's down, and I heard Buzz Williams say that one time, hey, I'm an assistant coach. I'm like, back then, hey, I got to sign 2 players and I got to do 8 scouts. That's my job. And
yeah, tunnel vision.
Yeah. You know? And it's important. Yeah. Obviously those things are really important. I mean, nothing is really more important than who's on your team, obviously. And then, but as a head coach, there's more to it. And some of it is the recruiting of the staff is almost just as important for the head coach as it is for the players. Cause ultimately those are going to be the guys that help you recruit the players and have the most touch points with the players.
So leading into this, I mean, you said how you made a lot of mistakes in your young career, and I'm sure many people can sit there and say, yeah. many people can sit there and say very similar things, right? Nobody had a perfect path, and that ultimately got you essentially to where you are now, at least learning from those mistakes. But what kind of things did you focus on young in your career, early in your career, to really set yourself apart or just at least – like, I guess what I'm getting at is, were you really focused on the X's and O's portion? Were you really just, hey, whatever you guys give me, that's what I'm going to do? Coach Larinaga, whatever they gave you. Was there anything you
dialed? Yeah, no, I think you've got to be well-rounded. I think when you're a Division III player, right, like, it's as if you didn't play. You know, unless you're Mike Rhodes, who's National Player of the Year. But even then, like, who knows? Like, even then, I'm not sure that these guys here – really care. So I think when you're in that seat, you better really have a good understanding of the game and how to teach and how to help players get better. And I think I was able to do that, especially as I got, probably when we got to Miami, we start to have like more access to the players in terms of time, and you're out there with them more. So I spent a lot of time there, but also recruiting is such an important thing when you have not come from a place of, hey, I've been doing this for 15 years or something, trying to get to know as many people, high school coaches, AU coaches, evaluating on the phones, all that stuff. Now, what's happened is, in some ways, it's shifted now. It's less of the, I'll say, relationship piece as much as it's the evaluation piece. You're evaluating the situation, you're evaluating the player, you're evaluating the character. Those things are actually, it's always been super important, but some of this is, you could, in the old days, you could evaluate it your butt off. You had no access to that player because of, you had no relationship and all that. So I think trying to be well-rounded, you're always going to have some blind spots, right? There's going to be some holes in your game, whatever that is, but you try to minimize those as much as you can and be able to do, hey, you got to be able to do film. You got to be able to do film exchange. You got to be able to work a guy out. You got to be able to do scouts. You got to be able to call, be a recruit. You got to be able to meet with donor. All those things that, you know, if you think that's just not my job, it may not be where you are, but ultimately you want to try to find a way to, if you want to be a head coach someday, you got to at least get some access to that, or at least have an understanding of, hey, I might not be doing any of this now, and I've got to do a great job in my area. But I have to have a sense of, at some point, I'm going to have to know at least how to go about getting better at that. I would say not skipping steps. You're not going outside of your responsibility. But one of the good things about Coach Larinaga was, I think he really let us in a lot on all these things. Hey, this is what I'm doing right now. I think that's important too for a head coach, Alan. I'm sure when you were a head coach, hey guys, don't think that I'm not doing this too. Hey, I need you to do this. It's not that I'm just pushing that aside to you. It's that I've got this over here I've got to deal with right now. So I need you to do some of this here, and then we'll come together about it. I think if you're not telling the guys what's going on, then your staff might be like, what's he doing right now?
Exactly. No, that's so true, man. That is so true. You hit on two things there that are really important. The first being that if you become well-rounded, say that fast 3 times, well-rounded as an assistant, what it does is it helps create these little snapshots for when you do become a head coach. It helps you understand what you personally want those things to look like. when it's your turn, when you've had a chance to do those. And then you said something really good for people that, you know, a huge portion of Rising Coaches followers, subscribers, members, young, oftentimes support roles, VCs, player development, what have you. Those guys may not have the pedigree of a guy that was all conference in the AC for 3 years that now wants to become a coach. So when you're a young coach, you've got to focus, and you're maybe, you, like you said, you play D3, like unless you're all American or something, and maybe went overseas for 5 years, guys don't care. So you got to focus on your performance if you don't have the pedigree. Because some guys come in with the pedigree and then their performance can just fill in as it.
And I tell you, we had this great GA program at Miami and we've kept it up here. And this year, just to give me a sense, we had 3 of the 30 NBA video coordinators that were Miami GAs. We had Mike Burgemeister, ran the offense for Auburn, was our manager. We've had a number of guys, assistant coaches in the NBA. Nick Friedman was with the Hornets. Chase Allen was with the Suns. Like, we've had a lot of guys that were in that program. And we've been able to keep it up a little bit here at GW as well. And the one thing we tell the really good players to come in, guys who are great players, is like, listen, okay, in about 30 seconds, they're not going to care that you were a really good player, right? After the first 30 seconds, you know, that they're not going to care. What they are going to care about is, can you help them get better? And it doesn't matter if you're a Division III player, if you're a manager, whatever. Like, after a while, it's, can you help them get better? Do they find themselves getting better around you? And then they're going to go to you, and they're going to be attracted. The real players, right? Not the guys who are faking it, but the guys who are the real players that want to really achieve and be really good, they're going to have to know that you can help them get better. And just, hey, if you didn't play or you were a Division III player, you've got to really be tight with that, right? It almost works the other way, right? If there's guys listening on here that were great players, listen, they're not going to care about that after a while. And if it's, when I played, this is what we did, like, that shit gets old too. You know what I mean? Right. So you have to be able to demonstrate that you're helping them get better. And that's just not on the court always. That could be film, that could be just in the office, that could be
day-to-day, you know, conversations.
Exactly. That's all player development. It's not just a drill.
So we kind of want to step into a little bit of GW, right? Your first year, as we said, you're going into your fourth season for everyone listening. It'd be the 25-26 would be his fourth season. So the 3 seasons prior, at least going back to the first 1 or 2, like, what was your kind of mindset stepping into that first year as a head coach? Was there anything that you learned?
I say this with a pretty good level of humility, I would hope. I really felt prepared to be a head coach because I was in a program for 20 years with a great coach in 2 different places, right? I think had I not been at George Mason, I wouldn't have totally understood what mid-major plus basketball was about. And then had I not gone to Miami, I would not have understood what the Power Five looked like and what it looked like at the highest level. But also, George Mason, we were in a little bit of position of strength when I got there. They had been to the tournament a couple of times. They were towards one of the 2 or 3, I would say, best jobs in that league. So you understood what life was like when you were in one of those places. And then certainly when we got to Miami, it probably was one of the, just in terms of resources, it wasn't, Frank Haith had done a nice job, and obviously Coach Hamm had done a great job, but it was resourced at the bottom, probably the ACC at the time. And so understood what it's like, hey, we're in a position of strength, we're in a position of not strength. But you still got to figure out a way to do it. And then having done almost every job within those programs, from being the volunteer, go get coffee, to being the associate head coach and actually coaching in games. There's a couple of games I coached because Coach Larrañaga was sick. So I actually coached a couple of games. Funny story is I find out like 30 minutes before I'm going to coach the game at Boston College. So 30 minutes before the game. And they've got Jerome Robinson and Kai Bowman. And it's like their best team in a while. And I don't know, like, there's usually, it's not a great crowd there most nights, but whatever reason, we had Lonnie Walker. Bruce Brown was out for the season at that point, but we had Lonnie Walker, and Dewan Hernandez got drafted, and they had Bowman and Robinson. So it was like, not only for whatever reason, the place was packed, but like every NBA team was there. I mean, Danny Ainge is like sitting right across from my bench. And like,
oh, of course.
And no disrespect, but there was a team in our league that had gotten on 0 for the league that season. I won't say who, I don't want to embarrass anybody, but as I'm walking out of the tunnel with the other assistants, I'm like, couldn't he have gotten sick at that place? At the end of that game. but anyway, so I had felt very prepared to be a head coach. And yet, it was the first year of immediate eligibility transfer visits because we're coming off COVID. It was really the first year of NIL. And so in a lot of ways, you thought, hey, this is how we're going to do this, kind of goes out the window. You know, some of it, because it was a new world. And so I think being able to be adaptable was for everybody is really important in this day and age. I don't think you can draw on a lot of experiences and things, but in terms of like how you're going to build a program today is much different than it was, say, 10 years ago. And for me, I would say just the scariest days of being a head coach, Alan, is I was not one of those guys. I didn't have the whole staff. Some guys like have their whole staff the next day. I had an idea, but those first couple of nights when you basically have no staff, I had Lamont Franklin, who I kept here, we had worked together at Miami, so I knew him very well, and I was very fortunate to have him here. But other than that, like those first couple of days when you got no staff, there is no sleep. Yeah, there's no – and you find out very quickly you got to get a staff, like, because those guys are going to help you. And yet you got to get it right, so you don't want to –
you can't rush it. Can't rush it.
Rush it, but you got to but you got to get it right.
Well, I think those real are, quick, Chris. Yeah. I'm sorry. What? Staff, you hit on something there that I think young coaches need to hear. When you were hiring a staff, what were maybe like a couple of ingredients you wanted every guy?
Yeah, I think the first thing is the character of the person was so important, especially now. I just think I heard that old John Calipari line that I use, and I think it's a really good one, is you can have a bad deal with good people because things happen, right? Things happen in life, but you could never have a good deal with bad people. Usually if a bunch of bad people get together, even if it looks on the surface that it's going to be a good thing, it never winds up that way. We're seeing that a little bit now in the world going on in spots.
Yeah, right down the street. Yeah. Right down the street from you. But yeah, we've got it there because we don't want to piss anybody.
But I think the character piece, the type of person they are, the type of teammate they are, all that stuff, that you don't necessarily – you want – competitive people. So with competitive people, there comes a little bit of, there might be like a strong ego here or an edge here or whatever. That's not always terrible, but we don't want big egos. We don't want people to think that it's all about them. I would rather have people that have a strong ego about their convictions or what have you, but not that the whole thing is about them. So once you do that, once you've eliminated people that you think like, you know, that's not going to work or whatever, then you're trying to build a team. You're really trying to build people who have, you know, again, you want well-rounded, but you also want people with different skill sets, different backgrounds, diversity, all those things that I think strengthen an operation. And you don't necessarily want the same of everything, but you want playing experience. You want coaching experience. You want guys maybe that came from the manager background, administrative experience, and things like that. So yeah, I think a diverse staff in every way, the strength.
Yeah, it could be used for recruiting, or if somebody had similar backgrounds than one of your coaches, be a little easy. So yeah, I agree. It'd be easy to, or not easy, but it'd be better to have a little diversity too, people from different lines of work. Yep. Now, do you look for, I know you touched on this in the beginning a little bit, but was one of the things that you were looking for any like playing experience? Like, of course, going into the
diversity. I think, look, you can't have a, you can't only have a team of managers and running around and Division III guys and guys that are
right.
5'7" ball guys like me, or 5'8" ball guys like me. You just can't have a whole staff of those guys running around. Listen, even like having a, sounds funny, but I know they do this in the NBA too, right? We have a GA that's 6'9". Guess what? Like big guys, they get along with other big guys. They know what life is like being a big dude, you know what I mean? And if you can add somebody like that, there's value there. It doesn't mean there's sometimes, I coach big guys some of my years at George Mason, whatever. It's not that you can't coach those guys in skill development ever, but sometimes having a guy around like that, they almost whisper to each other in a different way.
Yeah, no, they got their own language.
At a different level. Yeah, they're just different. Yeah. So again, I just think you want diversity of experience. Being able for me to have a guy like Dwayne Lee on staff who played in this league when his St. Joe's team was number one in the country. There's value in that. Having guys like Eric Sebastian, Matt Colpoys, you know, on the staff who had worked in the NBA and the G League to be able to speak to that. I have a Sam Ebersole won a national championship in Division III. There's something about that. What comes with having been a part of a program that was good enough to win a national championship. Having Aaron Thompson, the young coach on staff who was all-time leading assists at Butler and playing the Big East from this area. I think the ability to build out a staff that's diverse, as I keep saying, in every way, in every single way, I think is really important.
Yeah, for sure. You got great balance there. Really balanced.
And then you'll lose them, right? If they're good, you'll lose them. And you got to be able to replace them, right? So we have Brendan Strong work for me. He's at Syracuse. Eric Rubenstein worked for me. He's in the Grizzlies front office. Zach Bovera went to St. Louis as the top assistant. If they're any good, they're going to leave.
Absolutely.
This level.
Yeah.
So players and coaches now.
Yeah, and that's what you got to do. I think you got to do everything you can to maintain. My guys here will wind up getting opportunities. And what I'm trying to tell our administration, and they've been great about this, is the players are going to change. We just know that. And we have six guys back, so we're in a good position there this year. But, like, we know everywhere the players are going to – if you have to change the staff and the players every year, I just think it'll be hard. And I know Nate Oates did it 2 years ago, did an incredible job of it. I really marvel at the job he did because he lost his whole staff and the team, and he was able to put the whole thing together and I think go to the Final Four. But look, that's not easy to do, and I don't know that it's easy to replicate every year.
Kind of on that note, is there a way that as a head coach that you empower your assistants? So you give them opportunities like to do film breakdown and then stand in front of everybody.
Oh, yeah, they do that stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Run drills.
Yeah, they're doing. I would say I'm good at delegating, and we give those guys a lot of opportunity to coach. I was given a lot of opportunity to coach, and I just think it's important. It's just the way we do it. It doesn't mean that's the right way. It's just, I think giving those guys an opportunity to really be involved in every aspect, it makes them feel like they're getting better, they're growing, they're learning, that type of stuff.
They get to
develop their own voice. Exactly. Yep. And the players, right? The players, when you demonstrate to the players that you have confidence in your staff, that helps your team.
It helps yourself. Yeah, what you don't want to be is around, like I've been around, not on my staff, but you hear about it where the players know that somebody is just standing there. You know what I mean?
And they're that's
recruiting
right.
Or whatever. They read it. Yep, they know.
For sure. No, you want guys that help make the music, not guys that's just standing there listening to the music. There's a big difference between the two. Is he fiddling or just finger snapping?
Exactly. Yep. Good point. That's good. I like that one.
Yeah. Al's always got the one-liners and the catches. He's always got the liners. Can always take something from him. But one thing that you have seen young coaches make, like a mistake throughout their careers, maybe it's somebody that has worked with you and you don't have to necessarily name them, or just something that you feel is a genuine thing that a lot of young coaches make, trying to make connections with other coaches. Because as we said, it's a very relationship-based thing. So is there anything that maybe you've seen, like I've seen a kid do so and I didn't think it was probably the best way of going about connecting, networking, whatever?
Yeah, you know, the only thing I would say, my advice would be, I think if the best time to build any relationship with people is when you don't need anything from them. And that's in fundraising, that's in networking. And then once you establish, listen, I don't have an ask here, I'm just trying to build out a relationship. Then the frequency at which you hit those contact points and what you're bringing to that contact point, right? Maybe it's an article, maybe it's an action, maybe it's information. Information is obviously so important. Maybe it's you're handing off, hey, Alan's the head coach at Charlotte. And I'm like, hey, Alan, there's a guy in Charlotte you should get to know. Here's why. He owns this business. He loves hoops, whatever. Hey, let me put you on a text with him. boom, you take it from just things like that, that I think are giving more than you're asking. And then there's going to be a time where you will ask something of someone, but it's always better to ask for advice than it is to ask for something. You know, like when you ask advice of somebody, they automatically become invested in the advice that they give you. If you ask me, Doug, hey, what do you think about this versus this? And I tell you, I don't know, let's talk through this. And then I kind of say, if it were me, I would do this. If you do that, I'm going to follow that a little bit and see how that works out and see if I was right.
Yeah.
See if I was right. You know what I mean? And when you ask for advice, people become invested in the advice that they give you. But again, if you need something from somebody, it's always okay to ask. There's nothing wrong with that. But if the only time you're in contact with people is when you need something, then that becomes transactional, what have you. So I would just say you try to find ways to build out good relationships with people when you don't need anything from them. And sometimes it takes years, right? It takes 10 years before, if you're in this business long enough, we all want to try to do this for a long time. You can't keep score, right? Of, I did this for that person, they didn't do this for me. Or what, you start getting to that stuff and you'll find pretty quickly that, you know, the score is never going to work out in your favor, but it doesn't matter. We're not wins and losses. It's, hey, that one thing that you did get out of this in 10 years might have been a huge thing.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And the 12 things that you gave away might not have been that important to you at the time. So this stuff has a way of coming around, I think, in a good way if you do it with the right intention.
Yeah. No, that's so good, man. Said.
Sometimes you got to look at yourself and see what the intention is, because a lot of times people might think that they're not asking, oh yeah, I'm just reaching out to this person just to build a relationship. I've seen that at least, I feel like, once or twice, but then genuinely they're exactly to your first point, they're asking for something, but they don't think they are. But coach, just to tie it all up and ultimately seeing where you are now, you obviously having a great thing going on over at GW, head coach position, and everything had worked out into a good position now. But looking back on that first position again, over George Mason, is there anything that you know now that you would give advice to your younger self starting in the coaching career?
I don't know if it was anything I would say you should have done this, but I think it's something that you hear, and I think it's really true, because we all get caught up in our own lives, even when we're young. If you're not married and you don't have children, the amount of years in coaching that you're in that position, you can never say no to basketball opportunities in that time. Because eventually you get married, you have kids. Look, you're going to have to, if you're doing it the right way, you're going to have to commit a certain amount of your time, of which we all know our time is very limited, to your family. And for most of the people that I know in coaching, they're very successful. They are with their family and they are doing this job. And there's usually not much else going on. And so when you're in that age group, in your 20s, and that's most of us, right? When, I don't know, that time period when there's no wife and no child, man, you got to do everything you can to grow. You got to go to every NBA training camp you can go to. You got to go to every clinic you can go to. You got to do every, you know, opportunity to go have a drink with somebody or go to a practice or whatever it is that you need to do to better yourself. You need to do that. Because I think, again, if you're in the business long enough and you get to be more, I don't know that I was an adult in my 20s. When you get to 25, maybe I became an adult. But like, once you start to get in adulthood, there are other real things in your life that are going to take you away from that ability to grow. And don't squander that time when you don't have. And also, I would say last thing is that also relates to taking jobs. Not that I was a guy who took or got involved in many jobs or anything like that. But man, like, your decision-making on jobs and life changes a lot when you're involving other people. But when you don't have other people involved and it's just you, you're really only thinking about yourself. So I think that understanding that maybe in the long term, that's going to change.
You
can take that job where your parents are paying for it.
You live in 7 different apartments in 3 years or something, to just that type of stuff.
Yeah. I get that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Coach, before Dougie lands the plane, Chris, number one, man, great to see you again. It's been a minute.
Yes, I know. So, same here.
Really good to see you, man.
I appreciate it. Yeah.
Thrilled for your success. That's a hell of a place there for people that don't know much about GW. It's one of the best kept secrets in the country.
Yeah.
As an institution.
Yeah.
As an institution. It's a phenomenal place. You're doing a great job there, which is not shocking at all to me, but we appreciate you doing this, man. Hang out with us a little bit when we shut it down.
Yeah,
go ahead, Dougie.
No, I just want to make sure to throw out there before we wrap it up to our conference, Rising Coaches Conference, collabing with U.S. Nike Basketball Camps and Snow Valley Camps out Westmont College, Santa Barbara, California, July 22nd. You can sign up on our website, on our social media pages, all of that. So be sure to attend this event because there's going to be a lot of good coaches speaking. And obviously, it's a Snow Valley and Nike basketball camp, right? So there's going to be a lot of opportunity. We talked on where you can meet people and get opportunities to grow and make connections. This is it. So
that's right. Asked me what I wanted to do. I wish I would have gone to Snow Valley one of those years. And where was it, in Iowa or something, or wherever the heck?
Yeah, they've got one. Yeah. And they do. Coach Showalter does one in Iowa. It actually used, one of the main ones used to be in California. That's back with Herb Livesey, old NBA.
I wish I would have gotten one of those back in the day. Yeah,
coaches came out of organizing that thing. So, great spot.
We didn't pay him to say that, just so everybody's aware. At least not that I'm aware. But no. Thank you for being on here, as we always say, and we genuinely mean it just from me and Al, for everybody to just give us a little time to be able to just learn about you, your story, and then not only us, but the people who are listening. It helps more people than you think. Everybody thanks us, but genuinely, it's not us. We're just the ones sitting here asking questions. You guys are the one feeding the information. So thank you very much for giving your time. It's always great to meet my twin too, right?
That's it.
The relative. So, no, but like I said, we're spoiled, and thank you for being on here. And everybody, that was another episode of yours truly, the Rising Coaches Podcast. As always, Alan Major, Doug Caputo, keep working out there, coaches, and keep rising. We'll see you all on the other side. See you soon. Help your players get more out of their training sessions with our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. As the official shooting machine of Rising Coaches and the number one selling shooting machine in the world, Dr. Dish provides an experience packed with more reps, more motivation, and just plain out more fun. Be sure to mention Rising Coaches for an additional $250 off select Dr. Dish shooting machines. I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in with us this episode. If you are not a member, want more content, or even be a potential member on our member spotlight to have your story heard, go visit risingcoaches.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Rising Coaches. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating, and review so we can continue to keep rising together.